You got it. Thank you, Jim. All right, so we're going to welcome Gary Moyer here again. Gary spoke to us, I believe, a couple of times now.
Twice.
Yep, and each time he's been incredibly well received, and he's a great historian. He's been involved in radio quite a bit. And I met him, I can't remember, you were looking for some information, I believe, and one thing led to another.
I forget the circumstances, but yeah, I contacted you. I was trying to seek the name of somebody or something like that for some research I was doing.
Next thing, one thing led to another, and here he is, presenting to us for the third time now. So Gary, just give you a little brief bio about him before he gets in his presentation. Gary has been in broadcasting for more than 50 years, working with CBC Radio and several private radio television stations, including currently CJNU, which I believe you're still there?
Yep.
Okay, here in Winnipeg. He served as a correspondent for Maclean's Magazine and contributor to Time Magazine, and was a broadcasting instructor at Red River College. And he's also written a book about the early days of radio broadcasting in Manitoba called On the Air, The Golden Age of Manitoba Radio. So today his presentation is going to be about, Before the Beginning, the Story of Winnipeg's First Amateur Radio Club and How Its Work Led to the Development of Commercial Radio. So welcome, Gary.
Great.
It's all yours.
Thanks very much. I am going to take my mask off because if I wear my glasses, it steams up and I have trouble seeing. So thanks very much. I do appreciate you inviting me again because I really I've enjoyed my last two opportunities to chat with you. And I always love to talk about something that I'm really passionate about, and that, of course, is radio. I hope you're not getting tired of me, because I admit I am kind of a one-trick pony. If you enjoy history, that's sort of what I do, and hopefully I brought a few sound effects and whatnot tonight, but maybe we'll make the presentation a little more interesting. But I guess what I'm saying is I hope I don't bore you too much. Before we get started, though, I would like to talk about something else that I'm involved in, and we're all connected, we radio people in one way or the other. But next year is the 100th anniversary of the arrival of commercial radio in Manitoba, and I'm the guy kind of who is responsible for trying to organize the whatever celebrations that we might have. And I must admit, with COVID, it is one almighty struggle, because you're never sure what's going to happen, and it's really hard to plan anything because you can be shut down fairly quickly, and that's sort of the situation we face. In any event, I wanted to just let you know some of the things that we are planning, and I would imagine that at least some members of your executive will be invited, or I'm not 100% sure how it's all going to evolve yet. But one thing that we are going to be doing is we're going to have an event of some sort, and we're going to try to bring together some of the pioneers of radio broadcasting. There aren't many still around, but there are a few, and we're going to try to honor them in some way. Ideally, the perfect scenario is that it would be we've asked the Lieutenant Governor if she would stage an event, host an event, marking the 100th anniversary. Nothing has been finalized yet, and again, with COVID, you simply just don't know what's going on, but hopefully something will come out of it. We're also hoping to set up displays at the Manitoba Legislature, perhaps, or in the Millennium Library, or they said they might even set up a display case for us at the museum on Main Street. So that's something that likely will happen. And another thing that's likely going to happen too, and again, this is where you people would play some sort of a role, is establish a Manitoba Broadcasting History website. That's what we're calling it. And right now, what my task right at the moment and what I'm doing is I'm trying to collect as many vintage radio voices as I possibly can. And If any of you have any old recordings of radio broadcasts around, by all means, do let me know, because we will certainly use them. And then the last event that is being planned is a kind of a neat one. It is a theater production. It's a musical production called The Last Radio Show. And again, this is the one event that we probably made the most progress on, but it's also the one that is probably just never know what's going to happen until you get really close and make sure that you're not going to be shut down. So anyway, that's kind of the broad overview. And as I say, it'll be wonderful if all of these things can be achieved. But with COVID, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But if anybody has any thoughts or questions or anything afterwards, by all means, I'd be happy to chat with you about it. Now, your organization celebrated its 100th anniversary not all that long ago. And as I just mentioned, we're about to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the arrival of commercial radio. But today, as was just mentioned, I would like to go back even farther than that, sort of into the mists of time, and talk about some of the events that led up to the arrival of radio, period, locally. And in the past, I've chatted with you about the important role that amateur radio, ham radio people played in the development of wireless radio. And without it, the groundwork that the ham people provided, the amateur radio people provided, certainly the medium would not have developed the way that it did, certainly locally anyway. Now, for the presentation tonight, I am not going to begin in Winnipeg, but I'm going to begin in a place called Fergus, Ontario. Some of you may know where it is. As I understand it, it's about an hour and a half west of Toronto. But Fergus, Ontario was the hometown of a young man called Reginald Fessenden. Some of you will likely have heard of him. And by all accounts, he was a pretty brilliant guy, but he became obsessed. He became absolutely obsessed with wireless. That's what they called it back in the day, sending sound over the airwaves without wires. Of course, Marconi and some others had demonstrated that it could be done. Telegraph messages had been sent back and forth, and certainly the most famous was the one from England to Signal Hill, Newfoundland in 1901. That was the first ever transatlantic transmission. Now, Fessenden, the Canadian, he was convinced that if you could send telegraph signals, you should be able to send voice and music over the airwaves as well. He just couldn't figure out how to do it. But he set to work dedicating himself on trying to figure it out. And he tried to get the Canadian government and some Canadian investors interested in it, but really there were no takers way back then. So he did what a lot of other people have done, and that was he moved to the United States. And he worked for Thomas Edison for a while, and he worked for Westinghouse for a while. But at the same time, he kept working and working and working on this way to send voices over the airwaves. And he would build towers, and he developed a spark generator, and he had this cylinder that went very fast, creating a huge number of sparks and electricity to send sound waves. He developed a type of microphone and a radio receiver, and on. All very primitive, but at the same time, all very complex. And I cannot begin to explain the physics behind it all and everything that went into his work. And most people, to be quite honest, thought he was absolutely crazy. They thought he was nuts. And they really thought that it couldn't be done. But lo and behold, if Reginald Fessenden didn't one day figure it all out. And he was in his laboratory in a very short little signal, but his voice was heard, a couple of words was heard over the airwaves without wires. And recently, and I ran across this on YouTube, I guess some hobbyists decided to set to work trying to replicate what Fessenden did using only the materials that were available to him at the time. It's a simulation, but it's probably somewhat accurate as to the way that radio sounded. And I'm going to try to play it for you right now.
My mom.
Whoop, wrong one. Sorry, just lost everything.
When I was a tiny baby, actually, even before I went to kindergarten.
This is Burton Cummings. You don't want to hear him. Well, maybe you do. Anyway, it was all very crackly, and it was all very difficult, and it didn't sound all that great. But boy, it must have been exciting when you think about it. Nothing like this had ever happened before anywhere in the world, where you could hear a person's voice when they were speaking without the use of wires. And that was the very beginning. Now, what happened next was on Christmas Eve, 1906. Fessenden decided to do a little demonstration, and he gathered some people around. And from a building, his laboratory, and it was located in Brant Rock, Massachusetts, right on the Atlantic Ocean. And he got his contraption all set up, and he apparently played O Holy Night on his violin, and he read a piece from the Bible, and guess what happened? There was a crew on a ship out in the Atlantic Ocean, and they picked up the signal. They couldn't believe it. Again, nothing had ever been heard like this before. Sound coming over the air without using wires. And it was picked up on their telegraph receiver. And just to try to make this a little bit more interesting, and again, I'll have to pause for a moment because I've lost my sound here, but they made a movie, maybe some of you saw it, about Fessenden. It was a television show. And here is how they portrayed that all of this came about in the movies. It's not accurate, obviously, but it is kind of interesting. I'll just go back to my presentation here. And I do apologize for this because I have, it's gone. Okay, here it is. Here is Reginald Fessenden and his first radio demonstration.
Transmission with those inspiring words from the Bible. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men of goodwill. We will be transmitting again 1 week from tonight on New Year's Eve. In the meantime, Merry Christmas, everyone.
From United Fruit Company steamship Carolina in Caribbean waters, entire transmission received with great clarity.
I guarantee the quality wasn't that good, but what those sailors heard was the world's very first radio broadcast. There it was. Now, I'm mentioning all this because it eventually all leads back to Winnipeg in a roundabout way. And I just want to continue on with talking about this Reg Fessenden for a little bit, because it's really hard to get a handle on who he was. You know, some books describe him as kind of a happy old uncle with a long beard, always puffing away on his pipe. He did have a long beard, and he did smoke his pipe. And then other books have described him as one of the most ill-tempered, miserable sons of guns that you would ever want to run into. So obviously, it probably is somewhere in the middle is what the real story is. But what we do know, though, was that he was a brilliant scientist, and that was his strength. His weakness was that he was absolutely useless when it came to marketing himself or his inventions. Marconi, on the other hand, was the master of self-promotion, shameless self-promotion, I think you could say that. And for a time, Fessenden was not even mentioned in the history books when it came to talking about the development of radio. That has changed a little bit recently. But Fessenden just was not good at selling his ideas. He was a scientist, and that is what he did best. And I think part of the reason for that is the very fact that Reg Fessenden never did see what he was doing as radio, at least not as we think of radio today. He thought that at best it would be a wireless telephone, that's what it would be used for, and it would be used most often by people in the shipping industry. He never thought of it as radio. However, there was one man who was very interested in Fessenden's work. And that man was an American. He was an inventor as well and a businessman, and his name was Dr. Lee DeForest. And DeForest visited Fessenden and witnessed his work. And, well, as I said, an awful lot of other people thought Fessenden was completely crazy, and they thought that even if you could send a voice over the airwaves, it would be no value anyway. Lee DeForest saw it as a little bit differently, and he visited Fessenden, and what DeForest had was a vision of what radio could become and what radio would become, a medium for spreading news, for spreading information, music, entertainment. He saw the potential. And DeForest even set up a wireless company. It would be a high-tech company back in the early 1900s, and of course he called it DeForest Wireless Telegraphy Company. Now, when DeForest Company got going and Fessenden decided to take a really close look at it, he realized that DeForest had essentially stolen most of his work and claimed it for himself. And actually, that was something that DeForest became quite famous for, and safe to say that Fessenden was not a happy camper in the slightest. Let the lawsuits begin, and they did. And again, talking a little bit more about Lee DeForest, he was a visionary, no doubt. He had a huge ego, by all accounts. He wrote in his high school yearbook that he never doubted once his own genius. He was a master of self-promotion, everything that Fessenden was not. And he went through money just about as fast as he went through wives. He had four wives, and he went bankrupt four times. And I'm being kind of kind to DeForest, because here is what one academic in the United States said to say about him. Her name is Dr. Susan Howard.
Lee DeForest is a roué, a cad, a thief, and yet probably the man most responsible for bringing radio broadcasting to the American public.
Okay, so DeForest did have at least one invention that he could legitimately lay claim to, however, and that was something called the vacuum tube. And as I understand it, it helped strengthen and amplify sound as it came into a receiver. Vacuum tubes were used for a very, very long time in radio, and probably, I mean, I can remember them, so I'm sure that some of you people here can remember them as well. But it was a very, very important step forward in making radio viable. And there's no question, as I mentioned earlier, that he did have this grand vision of what radio could actually become on a commercial basis. He was a big picture kind of guy, and he always seemed to have a deal cooking one way or the other. That was sort of the plus side. On the other side, as I mentioned, he was always seemed to be in the middle of a divorce, and he was always being sued for something. And Fessenden certainly wasn't the only one whose ideas that he had swiped, his patents he had stolen. And because of some questionable business practices, in around 1909 and 1910, things really got hot for DeForest in the United States. He was risked being charged with fraud for overselling stock and all sorts of different stuff. And he writes in his biography, "It was the period of my greatest gloom." I'm sure that it was. And in any event, it was not a great time for him, so Lee DeForest decided, probably it's a good time to take my act to Canada. And one of the places that he came, the first place that he came, was Winnipeg. As I said, all this leads back to Winnipeg. So it was April now, 1910, and DeForest had served notice that he was going to visit Winnipeg, and he was going to provide a demonstration of the wireless telephone. In other words, a demonstration of radio, sending sound over the airwaves without wires. Now, that is something, of course, that had never been done in Western Canada. And in early April, he showed up, and he claimed that it was all business. He said he was visiting Western Canada, and he was looking for locations for his wireless system that would stretch from Chicago to points west, all across Western Canada. And he brought with him a pretty good-sized entourage of people. He had a couple of engineers with him and support staff. And the very first thing that he did when he got here was he met with reporters, because he was good at promoting himself, and newspaper reporters at that time, obviously, because there was no radio yet. And they all lapped up whatever it was he had to say, even though most of them had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. Now, DeForest prophesied, and I'm quoting him here from a newspaper article, that in the near future, wireless would permit the distribution of news across the country. Music, he said, would be distributed by wireless entertainment. And he saw it all as a wonderful, wonderful development that would soon be unfolding. As I said many times, he was a visionary. Nobody else at that time was thinking like that. Most people thought that wireless would be used for something else if it had any value at all. Now, DeForest, while he was here in April of 1910, also spoke to the local business community and civic leaders. And in fact, he was honored at a lunch that they put on at the Royal Alexander Hotel that was sponsored by the Winnipeg Industrial Bureau. And he told them that he planned to set up a wireless telegraph company stretching from Chicago north right across Western Canada. Winnipeg would be the site of a new laboratory and a big factory manufacturing wireless equipment. Manitoba would be the center of it all, he said. And of course, the business people and the politicians and whatnot lapped it up. Wasn't it wonderful? Wasn't this DeForest a great guy? And of course, nothing came of any of it. DeForest, another thing that he did when he was here, he did a lot of talking. DeForest also spoke out at the University of Manitoba. It wasn't called that at the time, but member, I think he was one of the early members of your club. His name was George F. Reynolds. He was a noted historian, an amateur radio enthusiast. And he wrote about this event when DeForest showed up at the University of Manitoba. And here's what he had to say. He said, "The event was attended by an overflow crowd of interested citizens. The amateur wireless hobbyists turned out en masse, and DeForest spent considerable time after his illustrated talk answering their questions and discussing in detail the operating features of his transmitter and receiver." And Reynolds goes on to write, "It was a unique opportunity for Winnipeg hams to study the most modern wireless equipment, much of it on display for the first time in Canada." However, that was the plus side. Again, DeForest, a lot of the time, always seemed to be about a day late and a dollar short at almost everything that he was doing. And everything was not coming up roses in Winnipeg either. He'd hauled his equipment to the city by train from New York City. And when it got here, he found out that some of it had been damaged. And what he had intended to do, he was thinking wireless telephone, was to make a two-way conversation between the Royal Alexander Hotel and Eaton's department store. Well, as it turned out, it was only going to have to be a one-way demonstration now from the Royal Alex to Eaton's. And it was quite an undertaking. As I said, he had quite a bit of a support staff, and they put up a great big aerial on top of the Royal Alex, and anybody certainly walking down Portage Avenue in 1910 would have noticed all of the activity on top of Eaton's department store. They had an aerial up there. They had big guy wires. They had all sorts of stuff. And so it was quite a show for anybody who was around at the time. And guess what happened? Winnipeg was hit by a huge spring storm. It was one of those cases where it was warm, it got cold, it started to rain, it turned to snow, there were high winds. The newspapers described horses were slipping on the ice and had to be put down, and the city was pretty much brought to a standstill. And this is a direct quote from the Winnipeg Tribune, and I used it in my book talking about the early hours of the storm, and it's written so uniquely that I just couldn't help putting it in there. And here's the direct quote from the Tribune of the day. It did not take long after the precipitation began for every hole in the street and depression in the sidewalk to bear overwhelming testimony to the ability of the heavens to expose the imperfections of the works of man. There were puddles in abundance and miniature lakes inundating streets in various parts of the city. Citizens, of whom it had been reported that they had not been known to swear for a very long time, permitted themselves to spoil a very excellent record by plunging into these pools and falling into profanity at one and the same time. So, reporters just don't write like that anymore. They just don't do it. Yeah, they have a certain flair to it. And what happened was, of course, the storm and the wind knocked down a good hunk of the towers on both buildings, and they were pretty badly damaged. So the big wireless demonstration in Winnipeg was going to have to be delayed. But finally, though, on April the 19th, 1910, all was in readiness, and DeForest sat down in his little makeshift studio in the Royal Alexander Hotel. And I'm going to let our old friend George Reynolds explain what happened next.
There we go. Well, what happened in Winnipeg was that Dr. Lee DeForest, the inventor of the radio tube that was used in radios for many, many years up to the advent of the transistor, had come to Winnipeg early in April 1910 with the intention of putting on a two-way radio telephone broadcast. Now, his party was registered at the Royal Alexander Hotel, and he made an arrangement with Eaton's to be on the other end of this two-way radio telephone conversation. Unfortunately, DeForest found that one of his sets of receiving apparatus had been damaged during the shipment from New York, so he was only able to put on a one-way demonstration. The transmitter was in the Royal Alexander Hotel. The receiver was in Eaton's store. The first, in fact, the only broadcast he made was on the morning of April the 19th, 1910. And, of course, there was a large crowd on hand at Eaton's store to witness the demonstration. And the first man to don the headphones to hear the voice of DeForest was the then mayor of Winnipeg, Sanford Evans.
And the mayor said, he was sitting there with his headphones on, he said he'd heard the greetings from DeForest distinctly, and so there it was, the first radio broadcast ever in Western Canada. Now, Reynolds, as you just heard, mentioned the large crowd, large number of people that had gathered in Eaton's, and the newspaper reported that many of the people showed up expecting that it would be a complete flop. They expected it wouldn't work, but it did work. And then apparently after the chat with the mayor, other people were able to put on the headset and listen as well. And the newspaper reported that some of the people described it as weird, supernatural, and mysterious. And why not? It's the first time anything like that had ever happened. So Lee DeForest had successfully then done his demonstration in Winnipeg. He had brought radio to Winnipeg. And away he went, and he was never heard from again. None of his big promises for the city ever came to pass. He went back to the United States, probably got sued a couple more times, and then he wrote his autobiography in which he called himself the father of radio. There was, however, one significant impact to DeForest's visit to Winnipeg, And it was that it really stimulated the interest of a number of young guys in the city, and they were mostly just young guys, teenagers, who were interested in wireless. And according to an article in the Winnipeg Tribune, there were a few young people, young guys in Winnipeg, who had been playing around with wireless in the city from as early as 1908. And that just blows me away, because that's pretty much 2 years before even Lee DeForest came along. But I guess they were getting the information from magazines or something like that. And DeForest had held his lecture at the University of Manitoba. And as we've already heard, it was packed to capacity, again, mostly by these young guys. And I think it's safe to say that a lot of the people who would have been at Eaton's that day were also these young teenagers that were interested in wireless. Lee DeForest had tweaked their imagination. And in 1911, a year after DeForest demonstration, what you have is the formation of what is likely the first amateur radio club in Canada. Not Winnipeg, but Canada. And it was called the Canadian Central Wireless Radio Club. And if any of you have any interest in this history of amateur radio, there's a full-page article in the November 18th Manitoba Free Press 1911. It's called Wireless Telegraphy or Telegraphy as a Hobby. And apparently one of the key players in this was a young fellow called Alex Paulson, 17 years old, and he came from a very successful Winnipeg family. And indeed, you had to have money to be in this hobby because it was expensive to buy the equipment. And the other thing that you needed was space. You needed a lot of space because this wireless equipment tended to be pretty big. And again, a lot of these young fellows, they put up aerials on top of their houses as well. That article that I just referred to has a couple of photographs. Paulson lived at 94 Cathedral Avenue in Winnipeg, and he had all sorts of towers and guy wires and everything else on top of his house. And this club was set up in 1911, and Paulson was the first president. And just as a little bit of an aside, I don't want to get sidetracked here, but 94 Cathedral is still standing. That house is still standing. But in the last year, it just came up in the springtime, the city, I guess, wants to demolish it, and the usual battle is on as to whether it's a heritage building or whether it's not and all that. But it certainly played a pretty important role in early radio in Winnipeg as well, that house did.
Is that close to Scotia Street?
Yes, it's not far at all. Yeah. And the Free Press article that I was mentioning says, although intended for a pastime, practical results have been obtained and messages are being sent and received at a distance of 4 miles from one station to another. And that's pretty good, 4 miles at that point in time. So things were really heating up. There was growing interest in the hobby. The Central Wireless Radio Club had about 40 members. And what happened next, of course, was that the First World War came along. And the Canadian government banned all amateur and non-essential stations for security reasons. And a good number of the young men in the Winnipeg Club went off to war. And certainly not all of them came back. But with the war ending in 1918 and 1919, the ban on amateur radio was lifted and an interest in the hobby started picking up again. And indeed, the military had made some real progress in research and development in wireless telephony, in other words, radio. And a lot of these young guys who were members of these clubs and were interested in it, they had soaked a lot of this up. They had got involved in the wireless stuff that the military was doing, and they came back probably more sophisticated about wireless than just about anybody else who was around at the time. In Winnipeg, Kelvin High School was apparently a real hotbed. It was just in its infancy. The school only opened in 1912, but it was a hotbed for wireless activity. They set up an aerial on top of there. And apparently one of the things I read that members of the club would do is that they would wind up one of those clockwork cylinder phonographs, and they'd stick their some sort of microphone in front of it and then play these records over the airwaves. So bad music right from the start on radio, I guess that might be one way of putting it. And the school, Kelvin School, technical school they called it at the time, actually offered a course in wireless, and the instructor was a young man called Ralph Foster, who had honed his skills in wireless technology during the war. Then in 1919, and we're still about 3 years away from commercial radio in Winnipeg, the Winnipeg Radio Club was formed. And I think, I'm pretty certain this is your club, right? This is the, I think it has continued on till this very day. And all sorts of interesting people in the Winnipeg Radio Club right off the bat. One of them was a chap called Graham Spry, who I will talk about just in a second. Alex Paulson came back from the war, and he continued his interest in the hobby. George Reynolds was a little bit younger, but he soon became part of it too. And there are many, many others. So why am I telling you all this? Because these guys were the young people who were really the first experts in commercial radio when it did arrive in the city in 1922. Ralph Foster, who I just talked about, he teamed up with a chap from Moose Jaw called Lynn Salton to get the first radio station in Winnipeg on the air in 1922. I've talked about it before. It was owned by the Winnipeg Free Press, and Salton had been a wireless operator too during the war. Graham Spry, he became one of the strongest and most influential advocates for public broadcasting, a public broadcasting system in Canada. If Graham Spry had have got his way, we would have been listening to nothing but the CBC. But he formed an organization called the Canadian Radio League. Alex Paulson, he came back from the war, became an engineer, did a great deal of writing sort of how to build receivers and how to do stuff you had to do to wireless to get it on the air, because it was also new. George Reynolds, again, as I said, he came along a little bit later, but he helped run the very first radio department in Eaton's department store. Another guy called Darby Coates. Darby Coates was a wireless guy too. I think he was a member of this club for a while. Somebody can check it if they want to go back in your archives. But he ended up running the first CKY in Winnipeg, the first public radio station in all of Canada. And there are obviously many, many others as well who made their contributions. And as one noted Canadian historian has put it, these young radio or ham operators were the first experts, teaching those only interested in listening to build and operate new equipment. They worked in radio shops, factories, and radio stations, providing their expertise to early retailers, manufacturers, and broadcasters. They were an essential ingredient in the mix for the takeoff of broadcasting as a popular medium. So, whether we are interested in amateur radio or commercial radio or public radio or community radio or any kind of radio, I would argue anyway that we really owe these early pioneers a great deal. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks a lot, Gary.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
That was pretty neat.
Well, I'd like to know more about the history of you guys.
Yeah, I think we probably would too. Yeah. over the years, you know, that stuff gets.
Just give them the key to the filing cabinet.
Yeah, I know. We're all. I know there's a lot of where a lot of papers are, but
yeah, I think it all traces back to that Winnipeg Radio Club.
You saw all those newscasters from way back in the 80s. There's a lot of articles by George Reynolds in there, and probably also Ed Henderson about the history of the club.
Yeah, Ed Henderson I knew. Short answer is no, I don't have that.
He has, our club newsletter going back to about somewhere around 1980 or even earlier, he's got a big pile of
Mark
over there.
Yeah, sure, that'd be fabulous, yeah. Yep, I'd love to get, you know, love to get that and read some of that for sure.
And I'm glad we got this recorded.
It worked, did it?
Yeah, and thanks a lot, Jim. So I'll just pause it here.